on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day out there, making some money, growing a business, getting excited for a business. Whatever it is, we are here to provide you the motivation to go and the insights, the tips, the tricks, and the techniques on various industries and ideas so that you might have a leg up there. Appreciate you being with us. Please tell your friends. We have a fantastic show for you today. Two amazing stories. Gino Barbaro is with us. He owns some 1,800 rental units. Amazing story. Started a decade ago, and now he has 1,800 units. He'll tell us the story and how to do it. It is fantastic. That's an amazing net wealth. And a lot of happiness there too. It's a great story. After that, Stacy Sherman is with us to talk about customer experience. And we're going to have a conversation. I haven't talked to anyone about this yet, so I'm really excited. Customer experience in an AI world, right? Do we like that? Do customers like that? Is it possible? And so very good conversation, great conversation with Stacy Sherman about that. So I'm excited to share that with you as well. So there we go. Great show for you today. Ooh, I got a bunch of emails about my comments on Airbnb. No, they'll be fine. They're just not going to be as big as they were. I commented that they're dying, but they'll be okay. They're just going to be half the size. We are back. And again, thank you so much for being with us. Very excited to introduce my first guest. This is a really impressive story. Please welcome Gino Barbaro to the show. He is a certified money coach, an entrepreneur, and a podcast host. But listen to this. As an entrepreneur, he grew his real estate portfolio to over 1,800 units, some $450 million in assets under management through a company called Barbaro 360. He is teaching others how to do the same thing and trying to restore some traditional values to our lives. Gino, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me on. Doing great.
Also, best-selling author of Happy Money, Happy Family, Happy Legacy. Amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell us about the story. How'd you get started in real estate? How'd you get number one?
Well, how I got started is from moving from, I think as Tony Robbins likes to say, moving from desperation. I wish it was inspiration. I was just desperate back in 08. The Great Recession hit and I was in the restaurant business and people weren't coming in. It was really difficult. And I was pissed off at the time. And I'm like, what do I need to do here? I had bought a couple of little real estate deals that had done pretty well. And I said to myself, well, let's see if real estate can help me out. I didn't want to fix and flip, Jim. I just said, I already have a job. What other niche, what other area of real estate can I get into? And I looked at apartments as the, I guess, as the avenue to get into. And I picked up the book by T. Harv Eker back in 2008 called The Secrets of the Millionaire Mind, which I would recommend to everybody listening to this. I mean, T. Harv, I can say just from that book and from even interviewing him, he completely changed my life. The quote in the book, you know, your fruits are in your roots, has stuck with me since then. And simply put, my roots were really shallow. They were really weak. There was no value that I was providing to people. Hence the fruits, the money, the outward appearance was also weak for me. So I took that to mean that, you know, Gino, you really need to learn how to create more value. You need to be more valuable in the marketplace. And I buckled down in 2008. I went out, found some mentors in the real estate space, and I learned the real estate business.
Awesome. Amazing story. So what are some of the lessons you learned? How did it go? Tell us some of the lessons and the stories.
Well, for myself, it was a hard pill to swallow. I had to realize that back then in 2008, all of the, how can I even say this? All the actions that I had taken up to that point had led me to where I was. And that realization, Jim, it really hurt because it really meant that I was responsible for my life, all the successes, all the failures. And once I realized that, to me, it was just invigorating because I said to myself, wow, if I take positive actions and I become responsible and I take control of my life, it may not be tomorrow, it may not be the next day, but if I start taking those actions and I start planning, hey, I can turn things around. Whereas I was back then, you know, living in victim mode and always blaming others. I was blaming the economy. I was blaming the president. I was blaming the restaurant industry. When in reality, Jim, what I needed to do was really to look inward and say, there's something wrong with what I'm doing. What are really successful people doing? And I think one of the first key lessons for me was really to turn to personal development, turn to one of my favorite, you know, speakers, Jim Rohn. I started listening to Zig Ziglar, big Tony Robbins fan, Napoleon Hill. I started to really control what was going into my mind and into my body. And from that point on, for me, things really started to change. And, you know, some of the learning lessons, really be careful of who you surround yourself, number one. And as Zig Ziglar likes to say, if you're looking at a target and you don't have a target, you're going to miss that target every single time. You need to have a target. And I didn't have a target back then. I was just wandering around aimlessly. Once I became aware of what I wanted to accomplish, what goals that were really in alignment with what I wanted to create in my life, what values that I uphold, all of a sudden I was able to say to myself, I like this real estate thing. I like the control. I like the long-termism. I like the responsibility. I was able to actually hone in and become clear on, okay, real estate is my niche. This is what I want to create long-term. This is really aligns with what I'm trying to accomplish. Once I was able to do that, I didn't lack the motivation anymore because I had the clarity on what I was trying to accomplish.
All right. I love it. And I love how you have dedicated yourself to improvement and you listed some great authors. I sat next to Tony Robbins at the Star Wars world premiere one time. And that was quite an interesting experience to see him in real life. So,
yeah,
when he was, on performance mode, mm-hmm. See what he acted like. Anyway, so great information from all of these fantastic mentors. And I understand why you decided real estate. How did you go after apartment buildings first? Normally people do the flip first and get a little experience there and then move into multifamily. How did you start off with multifamily?
That's a great question. And I would preface it by saying I didn't have any alternative. I already had the job. I was already in the restaurant business. I was already working 50 plus hours a week. I knew that I couldn't dedicate another 10 or 15 hours a week going out, looking for a property, fixing the property up, flipping it, and then getting on that hamster wheel again. I was already on the hamster wheel. I wanted to get off the hamster wheel, but I realized that, hey, to get into apartments, you need capital. So I, partnered up with my business partner, Jake, also partnered with my brother. You need some kind of experience or credibility. I started taking mentorship programs. So I invested a ton of money on the front end with my education, only because I knew that I'd made tons of mistakes and I needed to learn the business of real estate. For anybody listening to this, if you're considering getting into real estate, you need to understand that real estate is a business. Most of us, when we begin the real estate business, we think of it as, hey, I'm just going to buy a couple of deals. I'm going to flip the deal, or I'm going to buy this house and hold it. And those are all great sentiments. But you need to understand, if you're going to be successful in the area of real estate, you need to look at it as a functioning business that has systems, that has processes. Whether you're flipping a home, there's processes and systems involved in that, or you're looking to buy an apartment complex and hold that longer term. There are systems and processes. And I understood from the beginning, there was the three-step framework that we created, which was buy right, manage right, and finance right. I needed to understand that we needed to execute on all three of those pillars. So when I started, I had no choice other than to start in multifamily because I did not want to have another hamster wheel coinciding and running alongside my restaurant. And I said to myself, if it's going to take us a year, 2 years, it doesn't matter how long it takes me to close that first deal. You know, ironically enough, it took us 18 months to close the first deal. And after that, we closed our second deal 3 months after that. But I knew that if I had waited long enough and I had found and I, you know, poured over 100 deals to get that very first deal, I knew that it would pay off in the long run because I was trying to build a business that was, you know, running alongside the restaurant. And at some point I'd have enough units under ownership or under management that I could leave the restaurant business and get into real estate full time.
So how'd you find that first deal after 18 months? Walk us through that story. How did you find it?
Well, my business partner is a former pharmaceutical sales rep. And to say that he is an aggressive salesperson, I guess is a little bit of an understatement. It's like putting a bull in a china shop. And he was a little aggressive. You know, we're back in 2011. We're in Knoxville, Tennessee, you know, Stenziano and Barbaro, two Italian guys in East Tennessee. Y'all ain't doing business down here. It took a little while, Jim. I'm not going to lie to you. We didn't know the business, but we were, you know, we were really hungry. We were hard workers. And fortunately for us, we met a broker named Rick. And Rick took a liking to us. Rick actually liked the fact that every time he sent us a deal, we looked at it, we told him whether it was good, whether it was bad. And, you know, after 18 months, after the struggle, if you don't, I guess if you're listening to this, I hope you recall how tough it was back in 2011 and 2012. There were deals everywhere. I mean, Loopnet had hundreds of deals. The problem was the banks weren't financing these deals. The market, the economy sucked. We finally found the deal that had enough problems and enough problems that we could solve. A property that was in our price point, a property that had enough value where we could add, and we ended up finding a deal with Rick after 18 months. It was actually on LoopNet listed. He brought it to us. We negotiated with the sellers. They were what we call mom and pops. They were just two, you know, owners that were totally burned out. They wanted to get out of the business, and we were fortunate enough with Rick as guiding us. What a great broker. I mean, that's one of the things that you need to really be looking for when you get into real estate. These real estate brokers are they're a godsend. If you can find a great broker, it can completely revolutionize your life. But, you know, like I said, after 18 months, we were able to finance this deal with a 10% seller finance note, which basically the seller of the property took back 10% of the financing. He held a note for 10%, 80% from the bank, and we had to come up with 10% of the funds as the down payment.
How big a deal was this? Was it $1 million or five or...
It was 25 units and it was $700,000. And we still own the deal. We still own the deal to today. The deal today is producing between $8,000 and $10,000 a month in cash flow. It's probably worth $2.5 million today. And that's the beauty of real estate. It's not this get rich quick. It's this get rich slow. But if you commit to buying a good deal, being able to operate it, having some patience, and being able to actually operate the property, run the property, and give yourself some time, you can get extremely wealthy with real estate, whether it's the tax advantages, whether it's the cash flow, whether it's the tenants that are paying down the mortgage for you, whether it's the control. There's so many amazing benefits with real estate. I think when they decided to, write the tax code. The tax code is written to stimulate behavior. And unfortunately, you know, the government understands that it cannot produce, you know, housing. It just can't produce affordable housing. So what it does, it allows us as real estate owners these amazing tax benefits. And once you understand that, the tax code is written for everybody. It's over 70,000 pages. Dive into the tax code. See where you can benefit. Why entrepreneurs, why business owners have more tax breaks. To me, it was incredible. I mean, my father told me early on as a young kid, he said, "Do you know, it's not what you make, it's what you keep." And as a real estate owner, we're allowed to keep more of our money if we're there providing value and creating housing for the economy.
You know, you're not the first real estate person we've had on the show, Gino, and I've always heard LoopNet is where deals go to die. The fact that you mentioned it positively I'm sitting here in shock. Why did you laugh when I said LoopNet is where deals go to die?
It's interesting. You know, conventional wisdom would say that, but conventional wisdom should also say there are market cycles in real estate. LoopNet, deals go to die in LoopNet when the market's hot. The market has been hot from, let's say, 2020 to 2023, 24. You didn't need to put your deal on LoopNet because the broker would get a deal and he'd call up his 10 or 15 buddies and say, hey, I've got this deal. He'd put it out to his list or her list and they would sell the deal before it was presented or put onto LoopNet. And if you look at market cycles, this market cycle that we're entering is similar to what I see happening back in 2011 and 2012. There are more deals that are overpriced, that sellers are just not coming to their senses where they're saying, I want this price point. Brokers can't sell that deal. So what ends up happening is they end up listing it on LoopNet. Now, if you went back 2 years ago and looked at LoopNet, you'd find very few deals on LoopNet. Today, there are a lot more deals, whether it's Crexy, whether it's you're seeing deals on CoStar, LoopNet, auction.com, the MLS sites. There are more deals going on those sites as the market cycles shift. When there's a hot market, you're not going to find deals on LoopNet. But as the market softens, as cap rates continue to rise, and debt is harder to, I guess, get from banks, because debt is the circulatory engine of the economy, and it is harder to finance deals. As it's harder to syndicate and to raise capital from investors, it's harder to close deals. As you come upon all of these different elements of the market cycle changing, you will see more deals coming on LoopNet.
Wow, it's amazing to have someone defend it. I love it. So how would you go about finding our Rick?
Our Rick, that's a great question.
My Rick, when how do I go find my yes, Rick?
Yes, so you know, when you're starting out, you have to pick out my market before I find my Rick, and understanding whatever market you're in, whether it's Knoxville, Tennessee, where we are, or whether it's Ocala, Florida, really becoming intimate with the market and understanding everything about the market, what a rent is, what valuations are, what rents for a two bedroom, what the expenses are, become really intimate with that. And then the second thing is, well, once again, here's that LoopNet. You go onto LoopNet to look for the Ricks of the world, because the Ricks of the world will be on LoopNet. And it's really the Pareto principle, the 80-20. 20% of the brokers in a market are doing around 80% of the deals. So your goal is to find the 20% of the Ricks in the marketplace. So going on to all these various sites, and you'll find them. They may not have any deals listed, but what you need to do is you need to start connecting with them. Go on to websites like Colliers, Sperry Van Ness, Cushman & Wakefield, Marcus & Millichap, Berkadia, all these big commercial real estate brokerage firms. Start connecting and start putting your contact information in there, and they will start sending you deals. They'll start sending you offering memorandums into your inbox. But then again, there's also brokers on there, and start connecting with the brokers and start reaching out to the brokers. And more importantly, once you have a deal with a broker, you know, these brokers, these Ricks of the world, they're too busy. They don't want to go out for a cup of coffee. But what they do want to do is they want to go out and show properties. So as you're connecting with the Ricks of the world, once you see Rick put a deal online on his website, say, hey, Rick, I saw that you've got this deal on 123 Main Street. Can we do a property tour? And that's what Rick wants to do. He wants to sell property. He wants to show property, and he wants to build his list. And ultimately, for you to really stick out with a person like Rick is you need to do what you say and say what you do. And Rick wants a closer. That's what Rick wants. Rick does not want a waste of time. He wants somebody who's going to perform. So for you to be able to stand out and find the Ricks of the world, you need to level up your game.
So what would you do now, Gino, if you had $500,000 or something just sitting around and you wanted to get into the real estate space? How would you start off? Would you put it in one of these large funds that, you know, some people like you are putting together and ride along with you? Or what would you do?
That is a great question. I think the first thing that I would do, Jim, is I'd really look at myself and see what my goals are. Am I trying to invest this money to, you know, retire? Am I trying to invest this money to leave my current situation? Am I trying to invest this money for short-term gain where I need to, you know, pay for college or pay for an expense? I think I would ultimately look at that. I think the second thing that I would do is I would learn the business, and I would learn the specific niche that I'm going to be investing in. If I'm going to, you know, invest with somebody who's doing fix and flips, I want to learn the fix and flip business. If I'm going to invest with somebody who's doing apartments, I want to learn the apartment space, because what you're ultimately doing is you're investing passively, and investing passively is great. You have a chunk of money you're going to be putting with somebody. The mistake that I made early on was I invested passively myself, and this is what motivated me to learn the business. I invested with somebody who was not a good real estate investor, but you know, when I look back, I wasn't a good investor either. I didn't know. I wasn't a good steward of my capital. So if you do have $500,000 out there, earmark a small percentage of that to go on, to join a real estate group, to find a mentor, to have him or her teach you wherever you'd like to place the money. That's the very first step. Get crystal clear on why you're doing it. And the second step is to understand the business itself. Now, once you understand the business, the next step is, if you're going to place the money, look for a sponsor in that business, in that area, or in that niche, and make sure that the sponsor has, I would say, extensive education, extensive experience. I would love to see a sponsor, a real estate fund, have done full cycle deals, which simply means they bought a deal, they sold a deal, they exited it, and they made profit for their investors. And that's what I'm looking for first and foremost, if I'm going to be placing with somebody. And I love the motto of, hey, you learn while you earn. If it's your very first deal, why not invest it with somebody, put, let's say, $50,000 out of that $500,000 into a specific deal with a sponsor that you vetted, that you like, in an industry or in a niche that you like, in a market that you like. Find all of those elements, invest your money with that sponsor, and track that investment. See how that investment works. See how that sponsor does, and learn while you're earning. And at that point, you will get some confidence. You'll understand that real estate's not rocket science, because as I like to say, I was the pizza guy. My business partner, Jake, was the drug rep. If a pizza guy and a drug rep can become successful in real estate, anybody can.
I love it. I love it. Do you like these local real estate communities, these local meetup groups every Thursday afternoon at Jalisco's restaurant?
I do. And I actually ran one monthly. For me, they're more for the fix and flippers, the single family homes. But that's where you start, because you want to start to learn all the different industry, you know, leaders. There's going to be real estate brokers there. There's going to be title attorneys there. There's going to be CPAs there. There's going to be all different, professionals there. And once you go to these events, you start learning about the market itself. And then there you can start asking around and saying, hey, who would you recommend in the apartment space? And you may find people in that room that fit the bill. But if you don't, there's going to be people in the industry itself that can point you to somebody.
Where's the market going right now? And can you help me with divide it up? Where do you think the macro residential market is going? And then where's the commercial market going?
That is a great question. When you look at conventional wisdom, because I like bashing conventional wisdom, because they've been right about, two times in the last 30 years. Conventional wisdom would say, hey, we've got this oversupply. We're looking at all these markets. Hopefully, if interest rates drop. Jim, I personally think that it comes down to the economy. You can't make a prediction, because if we go into a recession, housing can get cheaper. But if there's people with less jobs, if AI's is cannibalizing all these jobs. You're seeing what's going on with Amazon. You're seeing what's going on with Salesforce. There's some really high paying jobs that are getting eliminated. So taking that aside, you're seeing that these, people own properties at 3% interest rates when it's really difficult at rates at 6%. So if you're going to tell me rates are going to drop into the mid fours, then you have that real estate cycle where rates drop. I think it may heat up. It really does come down to local. I mean, if you're in an area where people are moving, where there's population growing, where jobs are plentiful, then there's more health in that market. But I think shorter term, we still have a lot of building going on. We still have a lot of supply coming online, especially in the real estate market where you're renting apartments. In our market, rents have been flat. And that's one of the things with inflation, that inflation is I don't want to say it's non-existent, but it really has tapered from the last couple of years because there's so much supply. We don't need rent control to control rents. We need supply of apartments. And whether you look at St. Paul, Minnesota, or our market in Knoxville, when you add supply to the market, all of a sudden the demand, you know, will temper and rents will drop. In our market, rents have dropped. I mean, we're down 0.5% as far as rent growth. I mean, we had rent growth of 12-13% a few years ago when the dollar was cheaper, things were booming. But now as supply has caught up, that's what's happening in a lot of these markets. So just be aware of what market you're going into. For me, longer term, I'm always bullish on real estate longer term. If you don't have to sell your properties and you can hold on long term, I mean, real estate's one of the best investments for me.
And what about actually building? You know, buying a little piece of land and putting a sixplex up or something. Have you ever done that? What are your thoughts on that?
It's a, I don't want to say it's a difficult business. It's just one of those businesses where when I look at a lot of these builders, they seem as if they love to build, and then the market cycle shifts and they go bust. And then the market cycle shifts again and they build, make a ton of money. And then they lose it again with the bust. If you're getting into real estate, if it was me, I would never start with building a piece of property unless you come from a construction background and you have somebody you can partner with getting the piece of land, getting the land entitled. It's a longer process, much longer process where you have no cash flow from day one. So you have to be able to estimate the future. You have to be able to look out 24 months and say, this is where I think the market's going to be. You have to be able to pull all of that together and not get paid and be able to defer the payments. And then ultimately, business in real estate is all about an exit strategy. What are you going to do with this sixplex? Are you going to hold it? Will you be able to refinance it out and hold it? Or will you be able to actually, at the end of the cycle, sell out, recapitalize, and do it again? Those are some of the things that you need to worry about when you're building.
Great, great information, Gino. How do we find out more? Follow you online, invest with you, all of that, please.
Barbaro360.com. That's BARBARO360.com.
And are you taking investors right now?
We are not. We are self-funding our own deals.
Okay. But you're teaching.
Yes, I am teaching.
All right. Gino, great, great stuff. And we'd love to have you back. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jim.
And we will be right back.
Talk and no action on climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We are back. And again, thank you so very much for being with us. You know, nothing is more important than the customer experience. And we haven't talked about it a while. Specifically, we haven't talked about what it's going to look like through the lens of AI, if it's going to make any difference. I'm excited to welcome Stacy Sherman to the show. She has spent the last 25 years wondering these same things and dedicated to building stronger connections between people and the brands that buy from them, I've lost my, I lost where I was going with that one. She's worked with Verizon and a bunch of other amazing companies, AT&T. Stacy, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing great because I'm here with you.
Oh, that's so nice. I wish my teenage kids would say the same thing.
Yes, I have young adult kids, so I've been there.
You want to hear something really scary?
Yeah.
I have kids born in three different decades.
Ooh. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Wow, is right. Exactly. Tell us about good customer experience and bad customer experience. What makes the difference?
Well, First of all, a lot of companies are claiming that they are doing customer experience, which they mean customer service. They're not the same thing. And so I want to peel that back for a second and also say that there's doing customer experience and there's doing customer experience right. And I'm all about right, which is my brand. So if we talk about customer experience and customer service, I want people to think about that customer service has been around a very long time in the way it was 800 number and calling for help. And then obviously over time, it advanced to chat and other ways of getting help. And that's really reactive. People are calling or chatting to get help for a problem. Customer experience is a holistic approach. It's an experience management discipline. So if you think about how do people learn, buy, get, use, pay, get help, and there's a lot of micro moments within each of those interaction points with the company, that's customer experience. And when you are intentionally designing those positive experiences, those positive emotions in all of that, that's where you really boost your revenue and your reputation.
Who's great at it?
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I love your distinction between the two. Yes. Who's doing it great right now?
Oh, a lot of companies are doing great. I would say in a non-digital example, have you ever been to Trader Joe's?
Yes.
Okay. So most supermarkets, grocery stores, you would walk in and you hope that you find what you're looking for. If you happen to ask somebody, where might I find the new salad dressing that I just learned? Someone will point in the air and you miraculously have to go find it. At Trader Joe's, you walk in and first of all, everybody's saying hello, welcome. If you go enough times like I do, they might even know your name. And I'll ask somebody, hey, I heard about this great product, that salad dressing, which by the way, there's a community on Facebook of customers talking about the brand and the products that they didn't even have to create. The customers love them so much that they created this group. I'm in the store and one of the employees will literally walk me to the dressing or whatever I'm asking for. And they'll actually open the bottle and let you taste it. And I'm like, well, you don't have to waste it on me. No, we want to make sure that you love it. Beyond that, I'll do my shopping. I'll go to the cash register and get my groceries on the conveyor belt. And they're talking to me, the guy or the woman is talking to me about how different ways I can use these products. The best, most memorable that really hit my heart and the emotion of the experience is one time it was pouring rain and the woman at the register had an umbrella and she said, I'm going to walk you to your car. There's no reason for you to get all your groceries wet. And I see you not even have you don't have an umbrella. And I looked at her and I said, wow, that's really nice of you, but that's not your job. You don't have to do that. And she said, oh no, I do need to do that. Like, customer experience is everyone's job here. And I'm like, you've got it. You know, you're doing CX right so well.
All right. How did that happen?
That happens because the employees are trained. They are trained from the inside on how to deliver customer excellence on purpose. And I have to bet, I didn't ask, but I know from my own corporate world that I've worked in that people are aligned on the metrics that matter and the customer experience KPIs, those measurements beyond just profitability. And so when everybody is dancing to the same music, has the same goals, and is trained properly, that's what happens.
All right. It's interesting how everything you described in your scenario, the escorting you to the item, knowing your name, all of that would be considered, if you didn't do one of those things in Japan, it would be the news of the town.
Well, true. And what I want people to realize is that get the CX, customer experience is CX, get the CX basics right. I mean, we're talking about things you learned in kindergarten, right? Say hello, say goodbye, say thank you, be helpful. Like, this is not brain science. What I do in terms of journey mapping and working with clients to help them really map out the experience, design the experience, and validate that they're meeting real customer needs, that, okay, that takes a lot of skill and practice and expertise. But what Trader Joe's is doing at the peripheral experience right off the bat, anybody can do that in their business.
So I like this word, and I immediately assumed what it meant. The journey map, is that the process that I experience when I go through an experience with you?
Yes. So if you think about any company.
It's almost like Dante's 7 levels of hell.
No, it brings lots.
Are there 7 levels of hell? How many levels of hell are there?
No, it brings a lot of joy, and there's a lot of different journeys that your customer might go on. But here's the news: they're on a journey with or without you. So you might as well design it to what's going to meet their needs, so they pick you instead of your competitor.
I love it. So let's go through one. Let's go through Trader Joe's, or do you want to use a different example? Yeah.
No, that's an easy one, but I want people to realize that if you have an online store, e-commerce,
Let's take it offline. I mean, online.
Online. Okay.
An example. I'm competing against Trader Joe's online.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let's walk through that customer experience, that journey map, please.
Yes. And just one caveat, realize that people actually switch channels. They'll go online, buy online, pick up at store. So this is not a straight line, but for simplicity. So if you have a digital product that you sell or service, you would bring your cross teams together. Now, whether your team is big or it could be a small company that has contractors and freelancers and partners, you bring everybody to the table and you literally discuss, how does your customer first become aware that you exist?
Right.
That's typically marketing, awareness and learning, all different ways. Is it social media? Is it a trade show? Is it a sales force, right? All the different ways. How does your customer learn about you? Once you've identified all the different ways that you offer them today, then you go into, how do they buy from you? They learned about you. They want what you have. How do they buy from you? What are the different ways? Is it just specifically e-commerce? Is it an 800 number, right? What are the different ways? In this case, we said online, so it's probably e-commerce. Well, what's that experience like? User testing is a big vehicle there, where you're actually making sure that your website design is easy. It's frictionless. If they add to cart and then they give their credit card, is it fast? Does it go through, or do they have a problem? And then obviously they abandon cart. So there's a loop behind the buy doorway. Learn, buy, get and use their product. Once they get it, how do they get it and use it? Is it easy? Is it hard? If you think about when you get a new iPhone and you have to replace your old data to put it onto your new phone, your contacts, et cetera, right? What's that like? What does the customer have to do to be able to use the product that they bought? Then obviously pay. That finance people who listen, they say, I don't have a customer experience role. Oh, yes, you do. Because if people can't pay their bill or they can't get their questions rectified, anything with the payment, if you don't offer the payment options that your customers want, that's a problem. It doesn't matter that it was easy to buy from you and get it and use it. if billing is difficult, you're going to lose them. They're going to tell others too. And then obviously there's customer service, getting help for whatever problem you are facing. And so that's a high level journey. And what you do is when you bring your different teams together who own those different pieces of that journey, one, it's very powerful because you let everybody know where does their role begin and end and the domino effect. Too often people work in silos. And so there's this disconnect and customers often feel like, wait, aren't you one company? Like what I just heard from someone over there and you're telling me you're different. What a point of frustration. So this whole notion of journey map and journey management is to help break your internal silos, helps you walk in your customer's shoes. And then when you have that really on paper, it could be back of a napkin if you don't want to use sophisticated tools. You then don't stop there. You need to go to your real customers and ask them, the experience that we've mapped out, does that meet your needs? Why or why not? What's missing? And then you go fix those gaps, and it's that iterative process. Make sense?
Yes, it does. It makes great sense. Good. I know that you're a mom of young kids. I want to tell you a little customer experience from my 20s. I ran summer camps, and we were the world's largest summer camp company. We had 89 camps running simultaneously across the world. And one of the things that we did that was sort of just kind of a fluke, almost a typo perhaps, was that our daytime program went from any time in the morning until any time at night, as late as 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock, we had to have the day students out of there. As a mom, what do you think about that from a customer experience standpoint?
So say that scenario again, that you had to, based on the time.
You can show up whenever you wanted, you know, activities started at 9, but if you needed to drop your kid off at 8, that was fine. We were already going to breakfast. If he wanted to come with us, he could. The kids can stay as late as 10 o'clock at night. Normal pickup is 9 o'clock. But if you need to have you want to go to a movie with your husband and go on a date and then pick the kids up afterwards, so you have the true day off. You don't have to take, go get the kid at 1 or 3 or something like that. You know, you can have a full day off and still put the kid in his bed at night.
Yes. So what stands out to me are a couple things which customer experience is about. One is flexibility for the customer. So you're allowing them, you're meeting them where they want to be. If they need a little time, they need a lot of time, they get to choose, and it's about them. And you offer that flexibility, which is wonderful. And it's somewhat personalized because it's not a cookie cutter approach that everybody has the exact same requirements. So that's probably a reason that they came back again and again for that personalized special touch that meets their needs. Obviously, you have to have a good service, a good product for people to even want to have that. And you solved a real need that they needed their time back, and you provided a safe place, reassurance, and a wonderful experience that they had peace of mind for their kids so they can go do what they need to do. So all around, those are some of the things that stand out to me in delivering a great customer experience.
It seems to me that when you go the cheap route, outsource, offshore, nearshore, whatever, that it end up in the end, it sucks. And then that company just, it's just never the same. What are your thoughts?
I would not make a blanket statement like that. I know very good outsource contact centers and outsource business solutions who have really great talent and learning and development. So it depends who it is that we're talking about, because I know fabulous companies, and but they have to be held accountable, and they're accountable to their customer, and their support team have to be supported themselves to be able to pay it forward. So it's not a black and white answer.
All right. As a small business, just the six of us, what do I tell my staff? What do we do to make sure that we're doing a great job of customer service?
So one example is you bring at your meetings that you have as a team, number one, bring real customer problems. Now, how do you know of any problems? They're probably out on the internet, social media, Glassdoor, Yelp. There's some chatter out there. Do you know what it is, and are you paying attention? Do you have internal surveys or feedback mechanisms? Bring the feedback to your meetings and talk about what are your customers saying and feeling about you. Problem solve as a group. Make sure it's on every agenda. Also, ask your team, empower them. What would you do in this scenario to make sure that you feel equipped? What do you need to be able to deliver a great experience? And make sure you have a pulse on that. Like, what is it that they need? Because they have different skills and different understanding of their role. There are times people will say to me, and I'll interview people across the organization or the company, and they'll say, well, you know what? I'm back office. I don't ever talk to the customer. I don't have that role. And I said, well, let's sit down. Let me help you understand how you really have an important role. Because without you, the front line can't do what they do. And there is this absolute domino effect. So those are just a couple of scenarios that I recommend.
How does AI change all of this?
So AI is a fabulous way to enable humans to save them time and be able to develop deeper relationships with customers, with each other, with their colleagues, et cetera. One of the best use cases I love of AI is that there's some tools that have an AI simulation. So you can allow, let's say, your sales team or salesperson or customer service member be able to practice with an AI simulation and make all their mistakes before they get on a real call or a first meeting. So that's one example, really good for learning and development, and it will train and it will score you. Number two is that if you are collecting customer feedback, and I highly recommend it, and you're measuring that, you can put all of the feedback into an AI platform, and there's many to choose from, and it will score the feedback and help you prioritize where are the biggest pain points that your customers are having and your employees, and be able to prioritize and fix them. What are the low-hanging fruit and what are the longer-term challenges, and then which ones are going to really move the revenue needle. So those are two scenarios that I love AI for.
You have a preferred product to recommend, a platform you like the most?
I am platform agnostic. I typically work with clients and give them, based on their unique needs, my favorite ones.
Okay. That's very brave to be an agnostic in today's world, Stacy.
Well, I am very authentic, and I really study the different tools because there are so many. And I want people to realize two things. Number one, throwing more tools at the problem is not the answer. More is not more. It's the right ones, and there's certain ones that do a lot rather than invest in so many. Because when you do invest in too many, they don't get used. It gets confusing, overwhelming, and it stifles your business. So that's number one. Number two, people are fearful of the technology. And so you really, if you have a team of people, you have to embrace that. You have to involve them and help them understand how it's going to help them. And I'd say the third thing My brain is moving very fast, so I just thought, forgot my third thing. But yeah, it'll come back to me.
We only have about a minute left. What about emotion? Is emotion now part of the metrics that we need to measure? I was told to ask you about emotion.
Well, yeah, it's important because emotion is the experience. It's the lasting imprint in your brain when you are working or interacting with a brand. And so it's how they make you feel. It's not just the rational, it's the emotion that you leave and that decides what you do next. And so there is a metric around that that companies can use and make sure that you are creating these emotional highs and emotional altitude, more positives than negatives, to ensure and predict what they'll do next.
Were you a Disney family?
I was, yes. And I know they have perfected that customer experience and happy feelings.
Have they lost it?
I have not been there recently.
Okay. There are a lot of people who are saying that they have. And that it's visible in lots of places that, they're ignoring their customers, the families, in lots of ways with the movies, the choice of actors, the choice of just everything. I could go on for hours about that. So I'm also.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I had someone who worked at Disney at executive level on my doing CXRay podcast. And I think I've asked some of these questions, and I think that we need to be aware of the past versus now. There's a lot of economic and political factors that what's in their control and what's not in their control. And that also plays into the customer experience.
Sure, sure. But the last time I was there, Stacey, Mickey Mouse beat up my kid. I mean, come on.
I'm teasing. Oh, okay. I was going to say, you got me there.
No. I still, I was born in Orlando. And so we used to go there every week. Every Wednesday, my father had off. And so we would go every Wednesday afternoon for my first 3 or 4 years of life. So, and I just don't see it as good as it used to be. So, anyway, which elevator company did you work with?
I worked at Schindler Elevator Corporation. Okay. Yes. Yes. And I never imagined I would be in that field, but boy, it was a fabulous place to learn about working with union, working with construction and maintenance plans. And I mean, it's not far from like a car dealership. It just happens to be elevators and escalators and those kind of moving devices.
Right. There was an escalator showroom building about 5 miles from us there on the highway. It's the funniest looking building ever. It's just the elevators. The rest of the building is missing. And it's so hysterical to look at. So anyway, Stacey, great information. And I appreciate learning about the AI and how it's going to change the CX. And I'd love to have you back. Thank you so much. How do we find out more about you, follow you online, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I welcome it. DoingCXRight.com is my website. That's doing, like you're doing something, doing CX right, the right way. And you can reach me on my website, and I'm on all the social channels by the same handle. And have a podcast and love educating people about doing CX right for the greater good.
Stacey, thank you so very much. And we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today. Have a great rest of your day. We are back real soon. Be safe, everyone. Take care. Bye now.